talk is quite a bit different from most of the talks given in this session this morning, but I'm sure you'll find it of interest for those of you that watch this disaster develop, and hopefully you'll learn something new about what actually happened and what caused, what were the main causes of the terrible flooding that took place during the Hurricane Katrina disaster here in New Orleans. Much of what I'm going to talk about has also been reported on by three different groups who have studied the disaster. They're kind of listed here in order of budget. So the one that's highest had the highest budget, the one that's down there, the lowest, Team Louisiana, had the lowest budget. My budget was zero, so it doesn't even show up on this slide. But basically, I'm a professor at Tulane University. When I got back after evacuating from Katrina, Tulane University was shut down for basically the whole fall semester, so I had nothing to do but go out and investigate these things myself. Now let me point out that I am a geologist, I'm not an engineer, so the few engineering things I'm going to talk about are very simple engineering aspects. And furthermore, prior to August 29th, 2005, my primary field of interest in geology was volcanoes. And I'd lived here for 27 years, hadn't paid much attention to the geology of New Orleans, but what I want to try and point out is in any area, the geology under your feet is still very important in whatever you decide to put on the land surface. So we're going to start off with the geologic history of this region, which normally I go back 4.5 billion years, but today we'll abbreviate that and start 5,000 years ago, where in these four panels, the present position of New Orleans is here. This squiggly line running along here is the present position of the Mississippi River. This is the present Lake Pontchartrain running around here. So 5,000 years ago, New Orleans was offshore. Sea level was still rising from melting of the glaciers. By about 4,600 years ago over here, New Orleans is even farther offshore, but sediment coming down the Pearl River drainage system is getting picked up by longshore currents and distributed as a barrier island or a long spit out in the direction of where New Orleans will be in the future. And so these are basically sands, beach sands, that are going to become very important in the story of the Hurricane Katrina disaster. By about 4,300 years ago, we start to see the Mississippi River Delta out here shown in green building its way out. And by about 4,000 years ago, the lobe of the delta called the St. Bernard Delta has reached that Pine Island Barrier Island, basically cutting off the drainage to the north and forming Lake Pontchartrain. And the city of New Orleans is basically built on these deposits deposited by the St. Bernard Delta lobe. As many of you know, South Louisiana has been built by the Mississippi River over the last 10,000 years. Started off with a delta lobe running out here, shown in blue, switched over to the Teche Delta in here, the St. Bernard Delta, which was the one we're just talking about, built out towards the east. The Chandelier Islands out there in the Gulf of Mexico are the remnants of the front of the St. Bernard Delta lobe. That was active between 4,500 and 1,000 years ago, and switched back to this position between 3,800 and 800 years ago, and then the current delta, the Plaquemine Delta, is only about 1,000 years old. Now these delta lobes were active simultaneously many times throughout this history. Deltas, of course, are formed as a result of river systems reaching a standing body of water, or the water velocity slows down, and so they have to deposit sediment. That causes the river channels to get choked with sediment and causes the river to find new pathways to get to the sea or whatever standing body of water you're running into. And so it breaks up into distributary channels. These distributary channels usually overflow their banks on a yearly basis. And as they overflow their banks, the velocity of the water is initially high. It then slows down very rapidly, depositing natural levees on the banks of the river channels. Between the natural levees are basically swamps that accumulate lots of organic matter and clays. Some of the organic matter gets high enough accumulation to become peat. The rest of it is basically clays or silty clays. Occasionally a river channel will breach and we'll get silty clays deposited out through a crevasse clay. But the point I want to make here is that what we have in a deltaic system like this is not nice flat layers, but all kinds of interfingering layers of the geology and the type of soils and material changes every 5 or 10 feet. And we have to take that into account when we're going to start building things on top of the delta. So this is a simplified geologic map of New Orleans, basically showing the present bend in the river here where most of the city is located. The pink areas along here are the natural levees on the current Mississippi River, but you see that there are also these ancient natural levees that extend out through the central part of the city. These are old distributary channels, either of the Mississippi River or the St. Bernard Delta lobe. And basically, these natural levees on both the older distributary channels and the Mississippi River are the areas of high topography within the region. And in between, shown in green, are the swamp marsh deposits, which are basically very organic rich clays throughout the area. The gray areas are areas that have been infilled by human beings in the 1930s. WPA project built out this area on the shores of Lake Pontchartrain, and dredging of the intercoastal waterway along here in the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, abbreviated there as Mr. Go, put all this additional fill in this area. If we look beneath the surface in the area, this shows the location of the Pine Island beach sands where they're within 30 feet of the surface, basically running all along the northern edge of New Orleans. If we were to drill down, we would see that those Pine Island beach sands are present. And in particular here along the London Avenue Canal, which is where two of the levee breaches occurred during Katrina, the Pine Island beach sands come very close to the surface. If we look at that smaller version of that same map and look at a cross-section running along there, this is what we'd see. The highest natural point in New Orleans is in the French Quarter, about 17 feet above sea level. The natural levee drops it down into the central portion of the city down in here, where it drops below sea level. Then it comes up on one of these old distributary channels called the Gentilly Ridge, which is this part of the ridge. This is the Esplanade Ridge, and this section over here is called the Metairie Ridge. So those are all higher areas of the city and basically divided up into several bowls. We then get out to the lake, and out towards the lake we've got the fill that was put in there, but there were some natural levees up there prior to that fill. In any event, out in that northern section here we see the Pine Island beach sands coming fairly close to the surface. If we look at a flood map of New Orleans, this is an August 31st, 2005 flood map where the redder colors are the shallower floodwaters, the greener colors are the deeper floodwaters. Again, that cross-section going right along there. But you can clearly see these old distributary channels, that's the Gentilly Ridge, the Metairie Ridge running along there, and the Esplanade Ridge running down towards the French Quarter, which is located right in there. Now, on the morning of August 29th, 2005, Hurricane Katrina was approaching the coast, and this caused a rise in sea level due to the winds pushing the sea, called the storm surge. It was 18 feet of storm surge out here along the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, 17 feet of storm surge here along the intercoastal waterway, 11 feet of storm surge here in the central portion of the map area along Lake Pontchartrain. Storm surge that got into Lake Pontchartrain was coming in through these narrow passageways, one of which is Chef Mentor Pass shown here, the other one is off the map, and that's what brought the water in. One thing I do want to point out, because I have a very difficult time even convincing my students that this is the case, that all of these levee breaches occurred on the day Hurricane Katrina was making landfall. There's still too many people out there that think, oh, New Orleans survived the hurricane, and then the next day, all of these levees breached, flooding New Orleans. And that is not the case. That's the case that you would have come away with if all you were doing was watching CNN when it was happening. And I think what probably happened is people stopped watching CNN after about 4 or 5 days. when it was finally revealed to the rest of the world that all of these breaches occurred on the same day. And the reason the press didn't report it on the same day is because they were in the dry area and the floodwaters didn't get there till the next day. So all of the breaches occurred between 4:30 in the morning and 9:30 in the morning on the day Hurricane Katrina was making landfall. If we go out to the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, we see that those levees were severely eroded and as a result breached, which resulted in severe flooding in St. Bernard Parish. Basically, these levees were made of material dredged out to make the canals, very weak soils. No engineering really went into building those levees, although you see some steel sheet piling running down the middle of this one. But these pipelines that crossed the levee were completely covered with soil prior to Katrina. And severe erosion on those, mainly because they were made of weak soils, and there was no attempt to armor those levees to prevent the erosion in the case they were overtopped. The Corps of Engineers reasoned that they were authorized to build levees to a certain height. If the water level ever got above that height, they were not authorized to do anything about it, and so no armoring was ever put on any of these levees. If we go out to the area around Lake Pontchartrain, we see that flood walls were overtopped in those areas, and any place where a flood wall was overtopped, there was water running over the top as a big waterfall, eroding a trench at the base of the flood wall. So this is the evidence that we can go out and look at to determine whether or not a flood wall was overtopped or not, because the earthen levee is very easily erodible if it's not armored if the levee gets overtopped. So these are along the lake shore. This is near the lakefront airport. You can see swamp grass is actually trapped up here in the chain link fence. So it's clear that water came over the top of these flood walls and eroded the trench. Now these flood walls didn't fail, but we're going to see some other places where they did fail as a result of this kind of overtopping. And one of those places is on the Industrial Canal. The Industrial Canal connects the Mississippi River with Lake Pontchartrain and the Intercoastal Waterway Mississippi River Gulf Outlet System. It's a shipping canal. It was finished in the mid-1920s. This is a view taken from Google Earth of the Industrial Canal area of interest prior to Hurricane Katrina. two bridges here. One's the Claiborne Avenue Bridge. The other's the Florida Avenue Bridge, which crossed that. And this is a view on August 31st, 2005. The Florida Avenue Bridge being painted blue there, but you can see these breaches that occurred in the levee system, one long one about 600 feet long here, another shorter 60-foot breach over here. In front of that breach, basically all of the houses were removed. The storm surge level in the Industrial Canal was about 15 feet above sea level, overtopped the flood wall, and ran into a neighborhood which was about 5 feet below sea level, so about a 20-foot wall of water suddenly burst through this neighborhood. In between the two breaches, the nice rectangular pattern of housing in here is completely distorted because all of the houses that were built on piers basically became boats and floated around and ran into each other until they were completely destroyed. Here's a view of that area right in front of the breach, this one taken near the end of September. There was a barge that came through up from the Industrial Canal. There was lots of speculation as to whether or not that barge was responsible for the breach, but there's a whole bunch of other reasons why it breached, and the barge is really not necessary to cause it to breach. But what you can see here, again, is everything in front of that breach has been completely removed, no matter what kind of house. A few trees remain standing, but of even more interest, and this material in here is the breach repair gravel. It was used to prevent more water from coming in. But you can see the levee is running along here, but where it's breached, those gray rectangles there are the panels of the flood wall, and this brown ribbon strung out into the neighborhood is the 3/4-inch steel sheet pile that came down when the levee actually breached. So just briefly, I want to talk about the types of construction of flood walls and levees in the city. Levees are basically mounds of dirt, but in order to build a mound of dirt or a levee higher, you have to make it wider. And one of the problems they've always had here is once the population is there, you have to buy up lots of property in order to make the levee wider, to make it higher. So as an alternative, you put a flood wall on top of it. And there's two different kinds of eye walls shown here. The most common type, two common types of flood walls. The most common type is an eye wall, which is just a concrete structure built on top of steel sheet piling based on top of the levee, which would then require that the canal or whatever is on this side would have to get up above that flood wall in order to flood the protected side over here. The other type is called a T-wall, which in cross-section looks like an inverted T. And in this situation is actually backwards. There's actually armoring out here so that if the flood wall gets overtopped, it won't erode the top of the levee and will lead to longer stability. The T-wall is much more stable because when water gets up on the T-wall, it also puts the downward force on that bar of the T, which prevents it from tipping over. Plus, it has these A-frame bat piles underneath it, which hold it up in a much better sense. Now, the sheet piling that's underneath it is here in both cases. In this case, it's to provide cantilever support for the eye wall, and supposedly, at least this is what I thought prior to Katrina, would be there to cut off any kind of underflow of water through the pore spaces in the levee itself. We'll talk more about that later. Now, in 1985, the Army Corps of Engineers conducted a set of tests on eye wall types of flood walls. And what they found was that when the water level got up about halfway up the flood wall, that the lateral force on the flood wall caused it to lean over, forming a crack which allows the full hydrostatic force of the water to get down to the tip of the sheet pile. Now, 1985 was after they had put the eye walls on the industrial canal, but all of the other flood walls we're going to talk about were put on in the mid-1990s. This was known, but pretty much ignored for all of the rest of the construction of New Orleans. Well, if we go out to the industrial canal and look at the part of the flood wall that didn't fail, this is on the inboard side, we can see sinkholes all along the base of the flood wall. That is because the wall started to lean over, that material dropped down into the gap created when the flood wall started to lean over. If we look on the other side of the flood wall, this view looking north, we see where the flood wall didn't fail. Water coming over the top eroded a huge trench on the side, removing lateral support for the flood wall, basically. So if it's leaning over due to the force of the water on the inside and the support is being removed on the outside, it's going to eventually fall over. And that's exactly what happened. I think the water level got up to 15 feet above sea level, overtopping the flood wall, causing it the erosion of a trench on one side, also causing the flood wall to start to lean over until the whole system just failed. Now, the Berkeley group, who also studied this, claim that they think that underflow through these layers of humus-rich marsh deposits may have also undermined vertical support for the levee, and we may have got piping underneath the levee. But otherwise, the Corps of Engineers and the Berkeley group agree that this certainly caused failure of the levee system. If we now move back into central New Orleans, this is an 1878 map of the city. It's pretty fuzzy. If you're interested in old maps, you can buy this map at the Historic New Orleans Collection down on Royal Street. Beautiful map, very detailed, much more detailed than I can show here. But what it does show is that these areas that are more shaded in here are the areas that were populated with streets in 1878. Here along the high ground along the banks of the Mississippi River in this crescent shape, which gives the city its name, the Crescent City. And out here along Metairie Ridge, the cemeteries area, the beginnings of City Park out here, the fairgrounds all are along the Metairie Ridge, and then the Gentilly Ridge takes off in this direction. Well, they still had severe problems with rainwater flooding in this area. There was a natural drainage along here called Bayou St. John, but it didn't provide enough drainage to get water out of this portion of the city. So by 1878, they had these drainage canals, one being the 17th Street Canal, what's now known as the 17th Street Canal along here, the Orleans Canal along here, and the London Avenue Canal here. And if you look at where those canals end up, they end up at the ridges. So what would happen is they would take water out of here, put it in canals that took it to the ridge, and then they had a water wheel machine that they called a drainage machine, which would lift that water up about 8 feet and let it drain to the lake by gravity. In the early 1900s, an engineer by the name of Baldwin Wood invented these giant screw pumps, called the Wood screw pumps, that were so powerful they could drain an Olympic-sized swimming pool in less than 2 seconds. And they installed those wood screw pumps at the end of each of these canals so that now they can suck the water out of the lower basins and pump it up into the canals and let those canals drain by gravity out into the lake. Of course, with this new technology, they realized that all this swampy area between the ridges and the lake could now also be drained with the screw pumps, so they put the pumps on the sides of the canal and drained those swampy areas to make them habitable land. So that's where the first mistake was made. If we go out to the London Avenue Canal and look at pre-Katrina and during Katrina happenings, this is the London Avenue Canal. The water level in that canal is about 2 feet above sea level. The neighborhood out here is about 5 feet below sea level, so it's a situation that really shouldn't exist. These three drainage canals are the only places in the city where we do have water levels in the canals higher than the street level. Everywhere else, the canals are below street level, and the pumps take place at the eventual output, that is at the lake, to pump them over the levees. But again, these are here for historic purposes. What you can see here is where this drainage canal breached. The flood wall is missing along there. The force was powerful enough to pick up a house that was here, move it out into the street. That white spot is the natural gas line from that house bubbling up into the street. One thing that's important here is here's a tree that's basically in the same position as the levee breach. The Army Corps of Engineers' own manuals say, thou shalt not allow vegetation to be within 6 feet of a levee. And we've got all kinds of trees and all kinds of vegetation growing on the inside of these drainage canals. That tree is basically laying on its side here. It is entirely possible that the hurricane force winds blew that tree over, took out part of the levee, and caused the levee to collapse in that area. That's one possibility. If we go out and look at that area near the breach in this view is just behind me. You can see, look along the base of the flood wall. There is no trench there indicating that this flood wall was never overtopped. As the water level on the other side started to go down, here's that house that was displaced into the street. There's the natural gas bubbling up into the street. Here's the tree on its side over here. They've got sandbags in here to plug the breach. But as the water level started going down, we found tremendous deposits of sand appearing all throughout the breach area. And the neighborhoods were filled with sand. It kind of looks like snow. The cars had actually become large pieces of sediment that got deposited in the front yard of this house, along with all kinds of other debris. two big ridges of sand, the breach is back down here. We're looking towards the breach, big ridges of sand in the backyards. And eventually when they got bulldozers in to start clearing the sand, you can see all these nice geologic structures in the sand, something that we rarely see in New Orleans are outcrops of anything exposed to the surface. As much as 8 feet of sand were deposited in the streets surrounding the breach. And here's a map of the sand deposits. Notice that basically the channels were streets running away from the breach. I like to point out that if you connect the ends of these deposits, it forms the letter D, which in Greek is delta. This is a giant delta formed as a result of the breach, which took place back up in here. And I was able to make an isopack map of the beach sands and get a pretty good estimated volume of 932,000 cubic feet of sand, which if you stacked it on a football field from one end to the other, would be enough to cover the football field with 16 feet of sand. That's 6 feet above the crossbar on the goalpost. I was eventually able to get depth soundings run along these lines that the Corps of Engineers did on September 1st. And you can see that the hole here near the breach goes down to about 30 feet below sea level. But surprisingly, the estimated volume of the scour hole is only 365,000 cubic feet, which means that I still can't account for 39% of the volume of the sand that was deposited in the neighborhood, which suggests to me that areas both upstream and downstream from the breach were probably severely eroded, but I can't see that within the resolution of the soundings that were done. If we look at a geologic cross-section done based on soil borings prior to Katrina, that is, borings that were done to build that flood wall by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers or its contractors, this is a short section of that, which basically shows the flood wall here in gray, the artificial levee fill here in yellow, basically swamp marsh deposits shown here in green with some stringers of peat running through it. Our breach is down here, peat doesn't play much of a role, overlying the Pine Island beach sands here and eventually overlying Bay Sound clay deposits, which were basically that estuary that existed prior to the formation of Lake Pontchartrain. Now these drill holes are 3-inch diameter holes placed about every 300 feet, so there could be all kinds of little variations in between that we don't know about. But if you look at this black dashed line here is the bottom of the canal about 12 feet below sea level, and the sand clearly comes up into the bottom of the canal in several locations. But what was disturbing to me, at least upon initially seeing this, is these red lines are the depth to which the sheet piles were driven, supposedly to cut off underflow. And so we've got sand, very permeable material, with sheet pile that doesn't go down deep enough to cut off the underflow of water through that permeable sand. The sheet piles have been driven down to this Bay Sound clay, things would have been much better, I think. Just to illustrate how easy it is for that water to get through the sand, my seventh grade son did a science fair experiment. Now, this is not a scaled experiment. The Army Corps of Engineers spent $2 million doing centrifuge scaled experiment, which basically showed the same thing, but just kind of running through, notice how that quickly that water, and this is a sequence of about 15 seconds, runs through that sand. So basically the mechanism, the motive mechanism, or the motive failure of the London Avenue Canal at this point was the water level filled up in the canal, likely started tipping over the flood wall, but even more likely increased pressure on the permeable sand below, driving the water beneath these sheet piles, probably causing it to boil up as sand boils. We can't find those sand boils because everything was covered with sand later, but basically then causing erosion, collapse of the levee, and flooding of the neighborhood. If we go a little bit farther north on the London Avenue Canal, another breach occurred on the other side of the canal. You can see that breach here where the flood wall is running along there, as we'll see in a moment, completely separated from the rest of the levee, and it breached through in a number of places here. this breach probably occurred after the first breach because no houses were removed. The power of the water coming through was not enough to remove houses in front of the breach, although the flood wall on the other side was also leaning over by about 5 degrees, very much in a distressed condition. Here's a view, an oblique view from the air of this same breach. Again, this is on the west side of the London Avenue Canal, but you can see along there how the flood wall is completely separated from the levee where it originally stood, and then on the other side of the canal, that flood wall was leaning over. This was a slightly different situation. There were sand deposits in this area as well, but they were not as thick as the maximum 8 feet we found on the other side. Maximum on this side was about 2 feet, but also big blocks of peat were found coming out of here, indicating that there were peat layers in the subsurface of this region. An interesting, one of the houses along the breach area, the Mr. Cantrell, Daniel Cantrell, had built a clubhouse for his kids, and this is a photograph pre-Katrina of that clubhouse, which is clearly in his backyard. His backyard ends at that chain link fence. You can see the levee goes up behind it, and there's the gray panels of the flood wall on top of the levee. What you can't see in this photograph is that this tree is growing out of his backyard. It's not growing out of the side of the levee. When Mr. Cantrell returns home after the floodwaters have gone down, there's the clubhouse sitting up there at an elevation about 8 feet higher than it was before he left. You might say it's made out of wood, it just floated up there, except that the pine tree is also growing out of ground that is 8 feet higher than it was. Mr. Cantrell, as an engineer, he immediately recognized that this was the phenomenon of ground heave due to water pushing up underneath his backyard. If we look at the geologic cross-section here, this is the breach area. Colors are the same, basically. We see that there is peat, there is sand, and the sheet pilings just barely go down into the sand layer as well. But there perhaps is a thicker layer of clay and peat in this region than there was at the other breach, which is back here someplace. So what we think happened here is, again, water pushing through the sand, water in the canal, leaning the flood walls over initially, water pushing through the sand. We did find sand boils on this side of the canal. We found uplifted areas of ground heave that were probably pushed up as a result of the sheet pile and flood wall moving in that direction and the groundwater pushing up from below. And that basically undermines vertical support for the levee and flood wall system, which collapses not necessarily in this line of cross-section, but 10 feet outside of it in either direction to cause the failure of the flood wall. Finally, I want to move on to probably the most famous breach, the 17th Street Canal breach, which the news media focused most of their attention on. Or if they weren't focusing on that, they were looking at the Industrial Canal and calling it the 17th Street Canal. But in any event, here's the 17th Street Canal prior to Katrina. The 17th Street Canal is the boundary between Orleans Parish on this side and Jefferson Parish on this side. Google Earth rates the two parishes differently because the resolution is much lower on the Jefferson Parish side than it is on the Orleans Parish side. They were just finishing this bridge called the Hammond Highway Bridge over the canal when the Google Earth image was taken. Here it is, August 31st, 2005. This is the remnants of seafood restaurants, which used to be out on the lakeshore, which are piled up against the bridge. You can see the flood wall coming down here. There's a little piece of it right there, and it should continue all the way across here, but it obviously didn't. The main part of the breach is here, but you can see that the levee is actually bent out into the neighborhood along there. Here's another view of that, an oblique view. Again, the flood wall should continue along here, but there you see the flood wall and the water, and here's the levee bent out into the neighborhood. White spot in the water there indicates the location of a house that was removed by the force of the water coming through the breach. Another white spot there, another house that was removed. One of these houses came across and took out the corner of this house as it flowed down the street. There were trees in here that, again, could have gotten blown over and been partially responsible for the breach. I'm going to show you a picture in a moment of that yellow thing right there, which is, that's the roof of a school bus. We're going to see that school bus again in just a second. If we go out and look at the deposits, here's that corner of that house that was removed. You find lots of clay and big blocks of peat. No sand was deposited in front of the breach in this neighborhood because there was very little sand in the subsurface. That school bus that I was just talking about, this was a curious feature to me. In the flat plain of New Orleans, we don't commonly see sudden breaks in slope like the right there. I initially called this the toe of a landslide. It's actually the toe of a thrust fault. And basically, this house, this tree, these sheds were part of a whole block of material that moved outward from the levee out in this direction, sliding along this thrust fault. It actually tipped the bus over, but someone has righted the bus again because you can see the water line is at an angle there. But there's the standing water line in this neighborhood after the water sat in these neighborhoods for about 3 weeks before it got pumped out. If we look at the geologic section across here, we see it's a little bit different. The beach sands are much farther beneath the surface. Basically, we've got peat layers in here. But what's even more fascinating here is that the sheet pile, which is the red line here, doesn't even go down as deep as the canal bottom, which is 18 feet below sea level. I think they figured they had clays in here. These lacustrine deposits are clays, and therefore they didn't need to have the sheet pile cutoff go down deep enough, any deeper than that. But this is the thing that really is disturbing. And I've given this talk to sixth graders and they understand it, so I think it should be fairly understandable here. Whenever anything is designed, no matter what it is, we usually use a factor of safety, which is basically defined as the strength divided by the expected force acting on whatever it is we're designing. The Corps of Engineers uses a factor of safety of 1.3 for our levee systems, and in fact, levee systems throughout the United States. Now, if the factor of safety is greater than 1, it means that the strength is greater than the expected force acting on the levee or whatever system, and it should hold up. A factor of safety of 1.3 means that the levee is only 30% stronger than the expected force acting on it. If the factor of safety is less than 1, it means that it's likely to fail whenever we put that expected force on. So let's look at what we've got here. Now, this is taken from the state report on the Hurricane Katrina disaster, but it's basically a plot of shear strength versus depth along an 1,800-foot section of the 17th Street Canal. So they actually drilled soil borings, took samples of the soil, measured the shear strength. And so all these data points are measured values of the shear strength of the soil. Okay, the upper layers are soft clays. There's a peat layer in there. Here's the tip of the sheet pile down here, and there's clays beneath that. This big red line is the line that the Army Corps of Engineers used in their calculation of factor of safety. It's a standard line. It goes from levee section to levee section to levee section. Engineering judgment, supposedly. Notice that in this section up here, all of the data points have higher shear strength than the numbers they're using to calculate factor of safety. In this region and here, most of the data points have higher shear strength than the numbers they're using to calculate factor of safety. Below about this point, nearly all of the data points have shear strengths less than the numbers they're using to calculate factor of safety. Why even bother measuring those data points if you're not going to use them? So, just as an exercise, we don't have to go into the complications of how we calculate the expected force because it's just a ratio of strength to expected force. So let's assume the Army Corps of Engineers got a factor of safety of 1.3 for that point on their line. And now let's then use that ratio of 1.3 to figure out what they would have got if they had used the actual strength of the materials that they actually measured in one of the boreholes. So what's the same factor of safety if we use that data point instead of that line? It's 0.46. So obviously the whole thing is going to fail. Well, what apparently happened here is, again, the 17th Street Canal started filling with water. When the water got about halfway up on the flood wall, just like it did in the Atchafalaya Basin experiments conducted in 1985, the wall started leaning over, providing the full hydrostatic force to the tip of the sheet pile. That whole sheet pile canal basically then act as a bulldozer and pushed this whole levee, including this house, out along this thrust fault about 45 feet from its original position. And this all happened by about 9 o'clock in the morning on August 29, 2005. The Army Corps of Engineers, by the way, in their centrifuge experiments, duplicated this exactly and showed the bulldozing effect of the sheet pile flood wall, pushing things away from original position of the levee. So just to summarize, let's look at the contributing factors that led to this disaster. Obviously, the storm surge generated by Katrina was the biggest factor here. It increased the pressure on the bottom of the canal and on the levees and the flood walls. But then we have weak materials, including permeable sands, peat, and weak clays, all in variable states of array underneath the city. Certainly, trees uprooted by the hurricane force winds could have contributed. People often ask me, well, weren't there any eyewitnesses that saw this? And all the eyewitnesses were hunkered down in their homes with 120 mile an hour winds blowing, so no, there weren't any eyewitnesses that saw this. There was no armoring on the tops of the levees to prevent erosion after the levees were overtopped. And then we factor into that the poor design of the levees and flood walls that didn't consider all of these factors. For example, eye walls instead of T walls, low factor of safety, short sheet pilings, basically summarizing not enough consideration of the complex and variable geological environment in which they were built. I think there was a lot of complacency in this whole idea of trying to protect the city. So to mitigate those kinds of contributing factors, the first thing to do would be to keep storm surge out of the canals, get as far away as possible. We now have gates at the mouths of those three drainage canals on Lake Pontchartrain, and when those gates close, we now have a set of temporary pumps to pump the rainwater out over those gates. The industrial canal, the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, is still quite vulnerable because there are no gates on those areas. In terms of weak materials, drive the sheet pilings deep enough to cut off possible seepage to outboard sides of the flood wall of the canals. Use T-walls instead of I-walls. Every place where those breaches occurred, they have replaced them with T-walls with sheet pile that goes all the way down to the clay layer. Every place where it didn't breach is exactly the same as it was pre-Katrina, and so all of the weak places have essentially moved from where they've been rebuilt. But again, having those gates at the lake will go a long way to preventing a future disaster. Don't allow trees with roots that may penetrate the levees. Remove existing trees. They've made a big effort to go out and get rid of, cut down all the trees that are close to levees. So that's a big step forward. No armoring of levees. Doesn't cost that much more to put a thin layer of asphalt or something on there to prevent the levees from eroding once they're over top. And we need better oversight of the design and construction of the protection systems rather than when someone says, well, that's engineering judgment that we're going to use those values to calculate factors of safety, somebody's got to step in and say, wait a minute, that's poor engineering judgment. Easy to say in hindsight, but somebody should have thought that during the design stage. Now, since Katrina, I've run probably 150 field trips to these levee breaches. 2 years later, it's amazing, there's still lots of stuff to see. The organizers of this meeting asked me to do field trips for the meeting too, but I'm missing all of my classes today. I can't afford to miss them all on Thursday, so I can't do it. But if you're in town and you want a field trip, send me an email. Go to this website, in fact, if you want to see lots of pictures. Read the field guide, which basically talks about all this. But if you're interested in either going on the field trip yourself or contacting me for some future field trip, I'd be happy to run it. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you for coming, folks. Oh, yeah.
I'm just wondering the poor engineering judgment. Who's for? Who should
be
responsible for
that? Well, ultimately, it's the Army Corps of Engineers. They're the ones that had to approve all of the contractors' calculations. They actually did send it out to, quote, peer review, unquote, which was another office of the Army Corps of Engineers, which basically approved the whole thing. I think what all of these studies are saying is that we need outside review of this. The culture of the Army Corps of Engineers is, you know, they've been doing this for years, and they just kind of become a little bit complacent. We need engineers from the outside constantly looking at this.
Are they now take that lesson and do more outside review for the new design protection system?
Yeah, that's definitely happening. Yes?
What's the future of the ninth floor there that you already mentioned?
Well, I think it's, you know, they've repaired the entire flood wall along there. It was now a 15-foot above sea level flood wall. It was 14 and a half feet before. Well, actually, it wasn't 14. It was supposed to be 14 and a half feet. It was actually 12 feet because they were using the wrong dating for many years. In terms of breaching from the industrial canal, it's probably safer, but they haven't repaired the levees along the intercoastal waterway in Mississippi River Gulf Outlet well enough so that water can come in from that side this time. So I think it is probably about as safe as it was prior to the train, which is not saying for the lower nine. I think the uptown area with the gates at the lake were in better shape. Gentilly area, the upper ninth ward, is still vulnerable from the industrial canal because they haven't done anything about the west side of the industrial canal. Those flood walls and levees are basically the same as they were prior. Yes.
I'm just curious, you talked a lot about geological environment from the soil perspective, basically.
that kind of stuff. It gets into geotechnical engineering textbooks, so it's there. I think even somebody, a volcanologist, can read it and understand
maybe
it.
Maybe they do too much in the laboratory study, they did not bring it out in the field.
Well, I mean, initially they claimed, for example, that, well, we only had boreholes every 300 feet, the 17th Street Canal breach was in an area where we didn't have a borehole, and there was a weak layer of soil in there that we didn't account for. Well, if you're not going to do it that way, that factor of safety has to be large enough to take into account that. You may have some area that's weaker, but when you calculate the factor of safety and not even use the data you have, then that argument goes up as well. They didn't anticipate it because they didn't use the values that they actually meant. My wife says I've gotten a lot more down on the Army Corps of Engineers, but they made a bunch of mistakes. Now, there are lots of historical things. There are things that happened. The ebb and flow of the Hurricane Protection Project, which was started in 1965, was funded really well initially, and then funding goes up and down and up and down. Yes, they're under all of those constraints, but ultimately, they're the ones responsible for the safety of the people on the outside of those levees and floodlines.
So, in the end, the design criteria, the failure to drive the pylons deeper, et cetera, these were basically cost saving measures. Was it a question of building more levees that weren't as good versus really good levees but not the length?
I'm sure that played a role in all. The budget's continually going up and going down. You finally get to the point and say, well, we can't build any of this unless we start cutting costs. So let's use high walls and stuff.